In 1990, Randy Elkhorn was pastoring a large, flourishing church, seemed to have everything going his way, and he and his family decided to take in a pregnant teenager to help her. They convinced her not to abort her baby. They were able to share the gospel with her, and she became a believer. And she put that little one into an adoptive home where her baby could be cared for and loved and nurtured. But this whole experience developed in Randy and his family a greater burden for the unborn. And so after studying the scripture and looking at the culture, at his culture, he and some others began to participate in peaceful, nonviolent rescues. They would go to an abortion clinic and they would sit outside, far enough away from the clinic, but yet close enough to be able to plead with those who were desirous of killing their babies, to plead with them not to. And they were able to see some babies rescued. But through that, the abortion clinic obviously became upset. They called the police. Randy and some others were arrested, and eventually the judge determined that they were guilty, and Randy Elkhorn's church was told that they had to garnish one quarter of his wages and send those to the abortion clinic. Well, Randy said, there's no way, to the judge, I'll pay anything I owe, but there's no way I can let the church's money be used to kill babies. And so he resigned from his church. A second judgment was brought about because another abortion clinic heard about this and filed a lawsuit, and they were awarded the largest penalty judgment in American history against peaceful protesters, $8.4 million to be paid to this abortion clinic for sitting outside and peacefully demonstrating, which is just, obviously the judge was just trying to make a point. And he was told that for the rest, I think it was for 10 years, if he made anything above minimum wage, that went directly to the abortion clinic. And fortunately, his home, he had just paid his last payment, and it was in his wife's name. He didn't owe a dime of debt in anything. And yet, he was a very prolific author. So he began this ministry, soon brought in hundreds of thousands of dollars in book sales. But even before this judgment, he had taken no money for any royalties. And so this, the amazing part of this story is that when you look at this situation, you imagine as a breadwinner, you dads who have a wife and kids that you're supporting, imagine suddenly being told you can only make $12,000 a year, and anything above that is going to be taken. I mean, that would be a pretty devastating experience. But for Randy Elkhorn, he writes in the book, The Treasure Principle, he describes this calamity, quote, as one of the best things that ever happened to us. Now think about it. How can this kind of judgment, which seems so inequitous and so devastating for his family, how can this be described by Elkhorn as one of the best experiences, one of the best things that has ever happened to us? I mean, even to the point that 10 years later, just a couple years ago, when the judgment was over and now his ministry came to him and says, you're allowed to take more royalties, we want you to get more money than minimum wage, he and his wife sat down and prayed about it and they said, no, we have what we need, we're making it, we would just as soon leave it as it is. And then a short while after that, the abortion clinic refiled the suit and extended another 10 years, but it didn't matter. So why would he describe it as the best thing that ever happened to him? Because over the last 10, 12 years, all the money that has come in from the books he's written, anything that his ministry has taken in, actually 90% of that has gone directly into pro-life work, missions, and feeding the poor. So here, a judgment that was intended to destroy his family and send hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars into killing babies was by his sacrifice flipped around and turns out that they've sent hundreds of thousands of dollars into ministry. And as you read through that story, you just have to laugh and say, that is just like God. I mean, that is the gospel. The very thing that was intended to be the means of destruction was flipped around by God and used as a means of life, leading many to be rescued. This is exactly what Paul is talking about in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. This is what Ross proclaimed last week, that Jesus is alive. This is the gospel. Jesus came, he lived a perfect life, he died, he was buried, but that's not the end. He rose again, defeating sin and death. And as Paul says, if that's really true, then everything is new. Everything has changed. Sin and death and guilt have been defeated. And so, the Christian is coming at things from a completely opposite perspective. And they're going to start saying really dumb things, like Randy Alcorn said, that this is the best thing that could have ever happened to us. Look what Peterson's translation, which is a paraphrase of 1 Corinthians 15, 56 to 58. And I believe this is the climax of the book of 1 Corinthians. Read this paraphrase with me. It was sin that made death so frightening, and law code guilt that gave sin its leverage, its destructive power. But now, in a single victorious stroke of life, all three, sin, guilt, death, are gone. The gift of our Master, Jesus Christ. Thank God. Now, with all this going for us, my dear, dear friends, stand your ground and don't hold back. Throw yourselves into the work of the Master, confident that nothing you do for him is a waste of time or effort. You see what Paul does? The gospel is true. Sin, guilt, death have been rendered ineffective. Now, based on that, you can stand firm, which communicates stability, and you can throw yourself into the ministry, the work of God. Throw your resources into the ministry, the work of God. Throw your time. Why? Because you're not wasting your time, and you're not wasting your money. Because Jesus has defeated sin, death, and guilt. What is amazing, though, after talking about all these mundane, nasty day-to-day things like that he's been talking about all through 1 Corinthians, like immorality and lawsuits and other things that are good things, marriage, singleness, all these things. He comes to this climax in 1 Corinthians 15. He reaches the apex in verses 56 to 58. And then, this is my job today, to do chapter 16, verses 1 through 4. And you feel like, as you go from soaring in the heights of verses 56 to 58, down to verse 1 of chapter 16, look what it says. Now concerning the collection for the saints. You ever been in a service like that? You know, where you're soaring in worship, and then all of a sudden, somebody stands up. Now we're going to take an offering. You're like, oh, not now. It's like that. Have you ever been to Carowinds, that drop zone? You know, we go up about 15 stories. And you're just sitting there, and then all of a sudden, you don't know when they're going to do it. Somebody, some fiendish individual, pulls the switch, and you drop 15 or whatever it is, 12, 16, 17, I don't know what it is, stories. Just whoo. That's how you feel at the end of chapter 15 to chapter 16. Uh-oh. Back to reality. But you see, Paul had no trouble with that. He was very glad to be the guy that pulled the switch, because he was trying to communicate to the Corinthians, folks, when you understand the gospel, it is intricately connected to what you do on Monday morning. There is no disconnect there. It is intricately connected to the fact that there are poor people, and there are sick people, and there are struggling people, that there are problems in this life. And Paul sees the victory of Jesus Christ as perfectly consistent with connecting with where hurting people are when you understand the cross and the way of the gospel. And that's what he's been trying to communicate to the Corinthians. See, their philosophy was, okay, because the gospel is true, now everything mundane is meaningless. Let's just soar. And what Paul says is, no, because the gospel is true, everything mundane takes on meaning. Your work is no longer in vain. As you change diapers, and as you fix computers, and as you sacrifice financially or whatever it is, that takes on a totally different meaning now. Because it's not empty. Jesus won. And it's all part, it becomes all part of this master plan of God where he is moving us toward the ultimate culmination that he has planned. So Paul sees no shift there. Actually, he's pretty committed to this. He mentions this collection in Acts 11, Romans 15, 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, Galatians chapter 2. Over and over again, he mentions this. Why? Let's look at a few reasons why this was so important to Paul. Here he is, the apostle, the great apostle. Why is he messing with mundane things like offerings, a collection? Let me give you a few reasons. Number one, the duty of his calling. The duty of his calling. When James and Cephas and John extended the right hand to Paul and Barnabas at their commissioning and said, okay, we will reach out to the Jews and you will reach out to the Gentiles. The one thing that they admonished him to do was to what? Galatians 2:10. They desired only that we should remember the poor, the very thing which I also was eager to do. So part of Paul's missionary job description was remembering the poor. This was something that was heavy on his heart. He was not too spiritual to forget the fact that some people are waking up and going to bed hungry. That was a big burden on Paul's heart. Number two, the unity of the churches. The unity of the churches. Paul said in Romans 15, verse 25, I am going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints, for it pleased those from Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who were in Jerusalem. It pleased them indeed, and look at this language he uses, and they are debtors. For if the Gentiles have been partakers of their spiritual things, their duty is also to minister to them in material things. Question, why are the Gentile believers debtors to the Jewish believers? Why would he use that terminology? Well, who was the first to witness the resurrection? I mean, Jewish believers, right? Did they hide that information? No, they commissioned Paul and Barnabas and others to go and to tell the Gentiles. And so remember the principle we learned in 1 Corinthians 9. When you've been blessed spiritually, you're going to respond how? Financially. Paul was committed to that. He covered that in 1 Corinthians 9, and it comes up again in Romans chapter 15. That he cannot imagine, it's like, let's say you had cancer and someone traveled a great distance to bring you this one cure that had cured them and would cure you at great personal expense. They came to your home and they delivered it to you and you were cured of this cancer. How would you respond? Money seems like a small way to respond, but you'd be so overwhelmed with gratitude, you'd say, what can I do for you? I mean, I want to respond. I want to help you take this message to other places so that other people can be rescued. And that's how Paul viewed it. The Gentiles would be completely ungrateful if they didn't respond and saying, hey guys, thank you for the greatest news you could ever have told us. As these Gentile believers respond in a tangible expression of gratefulness, this not only, it's not like they can repay a debt, but it communicates the value that the Gentiles put on the gospel, number one. But number two, it also communicates the unity of the churches. Now suddenly these churches that were at enmity with one another, because one is Jew, one is Gentile, are now bonded together spiritually and even financially. That's why Paul says in 2 Corinthians 8:4, imploring us with much urgency that we should receive the gift, and look at the word he uses, and the fellowship of the ministering of the saints. He's talking about this same offering there in 2 Corinthians 8, and he uses the word koinonia there. That word fellowship is the word koinonia, the sharing, the fellowshipping. Jews and Gentiles are one financially. You could see Paul. I mean, he was like a young mother looking through the window and seeing her two kids playing together in the sandbox. Oh, that's a precious sight. I mean, they're not throwing things at each other for the moment. They're not hitting each other. They're playing together. And that warms that mother's heart. Well, same with Paul. When he sees Jews and Gentiles helping each other out financially, that demonstrates the solidarity of God's people, communicates the unity of his people, and he is giddy with joy. And that really lit his bulb to see these coming together. And the same is true today. It's very exciting when we heard from the Romania teams to be able to, they just came back from participating in churches, you know, in Romania, where one of the churches we support, we help pay for part of their building, going to places where there's gypsy villages and churches springing up. And through last year's offerings, we were able to begin the process of putting in wells in those communities because there's no sanitary water. Or in Albania years ago when we were able to send money for the refugees, or all these projects, Voice of the Martyrs each year, as we identify with Christians all around the world who are giving their lives for the gospel. Paul would say that is crucial, that we be connected with one another in a tangible, financial expression of unity and love. The third reason this was so important to Paul is the equity of resources, the equality of resources. Or you could use the word, this is a good word, reciprocity. That is simply a cooperative exchange of resources. 2 Corinthians 8, Paul said, verse 13, I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but by an equality that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack, that their abundance also may supply your lack, that there may be equality. Now understand, Paul was not a communist. Economically, it's not like he's saying everybody has to wear the same level of clothes and everybody's got to drive the same car and everybody has to have the same income. That's not his point. His point is that we need to totally rethink our value system as to why God has blessed us financially. Because most Americans, we assume that the reason God has blessed us financially is so that we can raise our standard of living. We can spend what we have on ourselves. What Paul is saying is maybe there's another reason that God has blessed you financially. John Piper hits on this in his typical straightforward manner. He says, God does not prosper a man's business so that he can move from a Buick to a BMW. God prospers a business so that hundreds of unreached peoples can be reached with the gospel. Brothers, many of our people have barely begun to grasp this. Too many are more shaped by the consumer culture than by the economics of Christ. They still operate on the simple rule, if you earned it, you deserve it, it's yours, use it for your own material comfort. Now the point is not to pick on the BMWs. He needed something to rhyme with Buick. The point is, are we consistently, as our income is increasing, are we simply raising up our standard of living, assuming that God is just so good to give us more money to spend on ourselves? Well, God is good. And he has blessed our country, not because we're any better than anybody else, but simply maybe because, as a part of his economic plan, he wants us to use those resources to meet a need, to provide for a ministry, or to feed the poor, or whatever it is that he has provided that for us. It's a totally different way of thinking. John Piper illustrates this from Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28. Simple statement about three levels of how to live with things. You know that verse, let him who stole steal no longer. but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need. You see the three levels? Number one, you can steal to get. You can steal to get. And even the unsaved know that this is an unacceptable way to live. Or number two, you can work to get. And most of us feel very comfortable with that, right? And that's good. I mean, we are called to be responsible and to work hard. And if you are a believer who is responsible and you work hard and you are an ethical individual, you're gonna earn more money given the right economic environment. So that's level number two, which is a very acceptable way to live in our country. But then the third level is you can work to get in order to give, is what he says. You notice he says that you may have something to give him who has a need. Now, many of us are very comfortable with level two, but we just haven't got it on level three. And the Bible is always, as you read through, anytime the Bible's talking about money, it's trying to shove us to what level? Level three. I mean, to start viewing things from a totally different perspective. It's not saying don't meet the needs of your family. Don't have a roof over your head. Don't drive anything. I mean, that's not the point. But the point is, once you have those most basic needs met, now you're pushing forward to move out of that mindset that we have more so we can buy more, but we have more because God has blessed us because he has a mission for us. 1 Corinthians 15:58. It's not in vain. He's got a plan. Are you a part of that? Are you connected with what he's doing there? Ford said, all human relations of reciprocity, that is a cooperative exchange of resources, are relativized by the God who enables, and he's quoting from 2 Corinthians, who enables every grace to overflow into you. Why? So that you in every way may overflow into every act of goodness. He summarizes it with the embodiment of grace is Jesus Christ. So do you see the reciprocity? God has dumped his goodness on you in such an unfathomable extent that for us not to respond back and share that goodness is unthinkable. And any amount we do respond and share is just minuscule compared to what God has dumped on us. This is where we're heading here. Paul doesn't view this collection, this offering. Do you understand why he doesn't view this as a mundane thing? He doesn't view it just as a necessary evil, which is the way I view that stuff. And I need a complete an alteration of thought. Because he didn't view it as a necessary evil. He viewed it as a massive part of God's economic kingdom in the building of his kingdom on earth. Well, what was his game plan? Let's just summarize this. Verse 2. He tells the Corinthians on the first day of the week, let each one of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there be no collection when I come. So number one, it was to be a weekly giving. He says on the first day of the week. This is actually the first appearance of evidence that the Corinthians met on Sunday. That the Christians or in the early church met on the Lord's Day. Why was it the Lord's Day? Because Jesus rose from the dead. That's why they gathered. So their giving was all part of reflecting the resurrection of the Lord. Number two, he says, let each one of you, did you catch that? Let each one of you, total participation, total participation. Paul was not targeting the elite. He was not talking to the rich only. He was not trying to simply put one group who had a lot of money on a guilt trip. That was not his point. As Elkhorn says, giving isn't the luxury of the rich, it's the privilege of the poor. That's why Paul, or Jesus, in Mark 12:44, when he was commending the widow, he said she gave out of her what? Her poverty. And Paul, when he commended the Macedonians in 2 Corinthians 8, he said they gave out of their deep poverty. What was he communicating? He's countering the very mindset that is a part of many of our thinking. We are convinced that when we can finally make it big, we are going to give. When I can graduate from high school and get a real job, then I'm going to become a giver. When I can go to college and get a degree and make the big bucks, then I'll become a giver. Ooh, when my kids, you know, and the hospital bills and when the school payments and when the mortgage is done and when all these things, then I'll become a big giver. And we spend our whole lives thinking that way, don't we? Just one more bill, one more credit card, one more payment, one more this, and then I'll really get a part of what God's doing financially. No, let each one of you. He was talking to people who were slaves. That was a big part of the Corinthian church. Dirt, raw, poor people. You say, Paul, how could you do that? How could you be so nasty as to talk to people who have hardly any money about giving? He said, how could I not? As Elkhorn said, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. It is more blessed to give than to receive. You will have far more joy than any getting you could ever imagine. If we could get this mindset, total participation. Number three, as he may prosper. I want you to lay aside something aside, storing up as he may prosper. That is relative sacrifice, relative sacrifice. Yes, we're going to give different amounts. Yes, different people have different amounts to give. And giving is based on what God has given you. You can't give what you don't have, and you don't have to feel guilty about that. It's one of the reasons we don't do the faith promise thing. I always feel weird about that. You know, God, if you'll give me this, I'll give it to you. And I think that's fine if certain people feel led to do that. But to have a church-wide program that supports missions, for example, simply on what we hope God will give us. No, let's give what he has given us. Let's start there. And then watch what he does. It's amazing. So he says, as he's prospered you. And he goes on to explain his motive, the motive for this regular sacrifice, why he wants them to be giving on a regular basis rather than just waiting till he comes. Look what he says there at the end of verse 2, that there be no collection when I come. I think this is kind of funny because I can identify with Paul here. Paul didn't want to step into town with tripod and PowerPoint and have a fundraising event. Now, he obviously is not against challenging the people to give. He did that in many places. But when he enters into that village and he wants to communicate the gospel there or encourage the saints, he doesn't want to be the fundraiser guy. He doesn't want to get the big event going with the elephant rides and the charts and the thermometers and all the rest. So he says, just sacrifice on a weekly basis so that when I come, we'll be ready to roll. To send that money to a church that desperately needs it in Jerusalem. Now let's talk about this for a second. If you're visiting, you're welcome to take a nap at this point. Maybe you've already done that. But I want to talk to the people who consider North Hills their home for a minute. Because every time we talk about money, you know, I apologize and feel bad and always feel like this is something that, you know, it's one of those dastardly things that you have to do every once in a while. But when you preach expositorially, you don't have a choice. When you come to it in the text, you got to deal with it. But that's something that God has really been convicting me about, as we mentioned in 1 Corinthians 9, is that that our giving is an overflow of the gospel interacting or coming in contact with our lives. If our giving isn't altered by the gospel has never entered our life, our lives. There's something that's wrong if it hasn't affected our wallet. And so it is crucial that we understand how does God view this whole thing. And first of all, I want to commend you guys. Because if you remember when we came to 1 Corinthians 9 and we dealt with this subject, and I encourage some of you to just put the training wheels on and begin somewhere. You know, start tithing. You know, wherever you are, even if you're in a deep hole financially, just start somewhere now doing what God has called you to do and begin there. And and tithing is like training wheels. It's a very elementary, beginning, basic way to start. But then watch how God blesses you. And the reason I want to commend you is most of you know, a few months ago, well, actually it was beginning of the spring probably, our giving just shot up. I mean, you guys heard what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9 and responded. And it didn't just shoot up for a week or two. I mean, it stayed up. So at a time when churches are struggling to make it, and it is so exciting because we have a number of missionaries that are preparing to go, and financially the mission board can do something to help them go because of your sacrifice. We get thank you notes all the time from people who have been blessed by the One Another ministry. The elders are now praying about planting 3 new churches in the next 3 to 4 years. Some here and some elsewhere. I mean, the specific plans are in motion as we pray towards God's provision there. Ross may say something more about that next week. But it is so exciting because of your sacrifice, your weekly, regular sacrifice. God's work is expanding around here and around the world. But as you know, we talked about a couple months ago, the elders, the deacons, the building team, and the church as a whole has determined that we need more space here. And so we are praying and moving forward to build what we call phase 2, more educational. It's not just to become a bigger church. It's to be able to educate the people God has given us. We have classes that cannot meet, classes that are meeting down the road. We have opportunities that we cannot take because of the space, the lack of classrooms and nurseries and restrooms, etc. You say, that's a big chunk. I mean, we're going to move from, it's about 28,000 square feet. To give you an idea what that is, this building is 24,000 square feet. So when it's ultimately finished one day, it will provide a lot of extra space. You say, well, how do you pay for something like that? And we have been approved to, we could borrow the amount and we could pay that payment, no problem. But even as we talked about that one Sunday a few weeks ago, that is not our desire, is simply to go that route. And then I got in the mail this couple months ago, this cool package. And it is really sharp. I mean, there are brochures and really neat stuff. Imagine a capital stewardship program as an exciting spiritual journey. And they talk about the $6 billion or whatever they've helped churches raise. And if you pay us, we will come in and we will help you raise money from your congregation in order to build this building or do whatever you'd like to do. And I know many churches, and they have lists of, you know, just hundreds of churches that have done this, and it's really some cool material. And I know many churches have done this, and I'm not condemning that, but I just kind of get sick to my stomach when I think of, okay, this is how we're going to raise money. We're going to pay someone a lot of money, I mean tens of thousands of dollars, to go to our people or to teach us to go to our people and get money from them or get them to give. And I think, why are we in that place? You know, where stuff like this is the way to do it, or being debt forever. And I think God's way just seems so much more simple. And I know I'm very naive in our culture to think, oh, that can't work, you know. But can you imagine if God's people simply took him at his word and gave on a regular sacrificial way? Let me just illustrate the impact that would have. You take, for example, our church. If the people who consider North Hills Community Church their church simply tithed, that is, just the most basic form of New Testament giving, not even, I mean really Old Testament giving, not even getting to the grace giving that the New Testament talks about. Simply beginning there, put the training wheels on and give 10% of whatever the Lord provides. We could build the whole phase two and pay for it in 2.5 years. Isn't that amazing? That's without any big campaign, without hiring a company, without doing anything special. Not to mention the anniversary offering or anything else. You think about what that would do in ministries as a whole, like the supporting of missionaries, because about 20 to 25% of everything that comes into our church goes into missions. I mean, that would just explode that. So as the elders and deacons have prayed about this and considered, okay, what should we do? We really feel like we need to come back to the simple, basic things that he's talking about there, and that is that through regular, weekly sacrifice, God's people take seriously the putting their resources into the work of the Lord and watching what he does as he provides. And this is not a condemnation, because we saw it happen a few months ago. And I think there's many more who had very good intentions that say, I just don't know where to start. And we want to help you with that. One thing we want to do is the deacons have just went ahead and got a copy of Randy Alcorn's book, the guy I mentioned at the beginning. It's called The Treasure Principle. It's only 90 pages. You could read this in a sitting. This is your homework for today. It's as you're leaving, one per family, there'll be a couple tables out there. Grab one of these, read it before shepherding group. It'll take you about 1.5 hours at the most. And that is if you daydream while you're reading. But it tells the story I told at the beginning, and it just gives a wonderfully exciting viewpoint. When I finish this thing, and I've read his 300-and-something page one, Money, Possessions, and Eternity. This is very crystallized. I mean, boiled it right down. I mean, you don't come away just feeling guilty. That's not the goal. You come away excited. Lord, what can I do? What can I cut out? I don't need cable. I don't need this. What can I do to put more resources into your kingdom? It's a very exciting thing. And some of you who live this way, I know you would say the same thing as Randy Alcorn. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. There's no other greater joy. I do want to emphasize that we're not going to start a building fund. What the elders are burdened to do is just, as you people, some of you can give $20 extra a week. Some of you can do more. Some of you can do less. And just give that into the general fund. Every few months, as the Lord provides extra, and the finance team can come back to the congregation and say, we're really excited to transfer another $50,000 or another $100,000 into this facility. So that as it goes up, we're able to pay for a big chunk of it as we go. And watch what the Lord does. Paul... Or look at the Cavens say. This is a family who really got excited about this. Alcorn quotes them in there. Once we understand that we are giving away God's money to do God's work, we discovered a peace and a joy we never had back when we thought it was our money. And that is so true. Well, Paul concludes in verses 3 and 4 by saying, when I come, whomever you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem. But if it is fitting that I go also, they will go with me. Paul is simply saying, when I come, I want to meet up with the person that you've chosen to accompany this money, or the men that you've picked to take this money to Jerusalem, and I will write a letter of commendation for them, and if it's appropriate, verse 4, if it's appropriate, I'll be glad to go with them. And this may seem like just a passing comment, but don't miss the fact that this is emphasizing Paul's commitment to accountability. That is a visible accountability. This is number 4. Visible accountability. And that's why in 2 Corinthians 8, Paul talked about Titus as having been chosen by the churches to travel with this gift to Jerusalem. And he said the reason he's done this, verse 21, is providing honorable things not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. Well, question, this is the thing I want to know. Did the Corinthians respond? And you have to answer kind of yes, no. Yes, in the sense of when they heard, when they received this letter from Paul, they responded with great excitement. Yeah, we want to do that. We want to help the needy Christians in Jerusalem. We want to give to this offering. We'll start doing it now. But then as they went along, it kind of faded. Because as he said, and look at 2 Corinthians 8, verse 10. It'll be up on the screen. And this I give advice. And in this I give advice. It is to your advantage not only to be doing what you began and were desiring to do a year ago, but now you also must complete the doing of it. He's talking about the offering that he mentioned in 1 Corinthians 16. He's now talking about in 2 Corinthians 8 that you complete the doing of it, that as there was a readiness to desire it, so there also may be a completion of what you have. For if there is first a willing mind, it is acceptable according to what one has and not according to what one does not have. That is so realistic, isn't it? We can hear a message or we could read a book and get all excited and set these high goals. And he says, but don't just stop there with good intentions. Start giving what you can do right now. Because as there was a readiness, also there should be a completion. They seemed to respond with great excitement up front, but then it kind of dwindled. Isn't that where we struggle? Lisa Welchel, when she was 18 and she was a star on was The Facts of Life, heard a Christian speaker talk about the plight of people in Haiti. She was so moved by it. She wrote in the book, The Facts of Life and Other Lessons My Father Taught Me, quote, "My eyes were opened to what a privileged life I lived and how totally unaware I was of what was going on in the rest of the world. I was profoundly moved and convicted." She went forward after that service. Immediately, she went up and gave her Rolex watch, her diamond ring, and her emerald bunch of jewelry to give to that ministry in Haiti. She went home and she was determined to downsize her home. She lived in a big condo and she lived alone. At 18, alone in this huge condo, she said, "I could sell that and move into something smaller." She said, she wrote in the book, "And I certainly didn't need to be driving around in a Porsche. Selling the car and buying a moderate car would free up thousands of dollars. I had money invested in real estate across the country. If I sold it, the money would feed tens of thousands of children. It was a no-brainer. My zeal was strong. I knew I had heard from God and I was doing the right thing." But then she went home, visiting friends and family, and she talked to them and they said, "You're crazy. It's irrational. I mean, nobody does that." And so she describes that they basically convinced her to just go back to live the normal way that she was living. But listen to what she describes in that book. Less than 10 years later, all that money was gone anyway. She said a chunk of it had been invested in a high-rise office building in Pittsburgh that went belly up. Another significant portion was in Texas land that dried up during the oil crisis and was eventually foreclosed upon. When I got married, I sold my condo, bought a house during the California real estate boom in the 1980s, only to give it back to the bank 3 years later when the bottom fell out of the market. The Facts of Life was canceled, and I spent all the cash I had making payments on everything for as long as I could. At 28, I was broke. She concludes, "God was trying to get me to invest my money in heaven where it would be safe, but I thought it was too risky to take him at his word." Folks, it's not about the poor. It's not about buildings. It's not even about missionaries. It's about the gospel. It's about looking at things the way God looks at them. It's about believing in a resurrected Lord that makes all our work for the Lord not in vain. Or all our sacrifice for Him, if we can call it that, not empty or fruitless. And yes, the world will look at us like we're insane. And yes, at the end of the year, when we tally what we made and what we spent and what we gave, sure, we'll be thinking, "Man, I could have bought a lot of nice things." But if the gospel doesn't affect that equation, then something's wrong, isn't it? The good news from the Corinthians is they heard Paul. When Paul wrote back in 2 Corinthians, this is one of the reasons I'd love to dive into 2 Corinthians next, because you get to see the fulfillment of that. But he admonished them to finish what they started and to sacrificially provide this offering for Jerusalem. And in Romans chapter 15, verse 25 to 26, he says, "Now I am going to Jerusalem." So Paul did end up going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints, "for it pleased those from Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who were in Jerusalem." Achaia is where Athens and Corinth are. He's talking about the Corinthians there. And he says, "It pleased those from Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who were in Jerusalem." They did follow through. And see, I find great comfort in that, because I see the same thing in myself. The Spirit of God works in my heart. I get all focused and ready to go, to make sacrifices, to cut back, to do whatever. And then, you know, my mind gets weak, or my will is dissolved. And then I start forgetting about doing that. And then the Spirit of God has to come back again, like Paul did in 2 Corinthians, and say, "Hello, do you remember what I told you? Don't forget. Let's finish what we started." And maybe that's what God was doing with hitting it in 1 Corinthians 9 and hitting again in 1 Corinthians 16. Said, "Guys, let's jump in and keep going and take it up a notch and watch what God does."